I'm Mina.
And I'm Madison. And this is
Weekly Wondering. Hi, Madison.
Hi, Mina.
How's it going?
Oh, we're here. We're living. We're loving. Happy October.
October.
It's not October at this current moment, but it will be when your ears are listening to it.
That's right. We are recording for Spooktober.
Spooky, spooky.
That's the
jingle.
That's the jingle.
Spooky, spooky.
Spooky, spooky. But until then, it is the end of September, which is cuckoo bananas.
Yeah. Can't believe it's the, you know. What did Green Day say? Wake me up when September ends. Good morning. It's time to get up, baby.
September.
September.
September was the shortest month. It felt like 3 days long.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now we're here.
I don't think we have anything to tell these people, right?
No. Welcome to Spooky Month. If you didn't know, we're doing 5 weeks of spooky topics.
Yeah. What else? That's it, right?
That's hell yeah.
Tomorrow's Madison's birthday, guys. Tomorrow as in Tuesday, as in the day after we record, not tomorrow as in Friday, as in the day after we release the podcast. If you are confused, September 29th is Madison's birthday. Send her... I don't know, lollipops?
Lollipops.
Send me cash. Send me cash.
Or like, you know, like, I don't know, a butterfly or something.
A butterfly. You hate butterflies.
I do. I'm really afraid of butterflies. That's one of my biggest fears.
Send her a butterfly lollipop.
Oh. That's like my my uncle used to get us at Christmas, like the lollipops that had like the scorpion in them.
Oh.
And I hated those so much.
Not those. But yeah, so maybe sing happy birthday to Madison on our Instagram or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. In advance.
For your birthday wishes. Thank you. So this week's topic, Madison, talk to me about it. What is it?
Welcome to Spooktember. That's the wrong month. Spooktober. We are starting off with talking about the horror genre.
Ooh.
Spooky, spooky. Thunder crash, lightning bolt, crash, crash, bang. All the spooky noises.
It's like the beginning of every Scooby-Doo episode.
Yes. And here to do this episode is Shaggy and Scooby-Doo.
Wow, Shaggy.
As you can tell, we've completely lost our minds, but yeah, we're gonna talk about the horror genre, you know, where it came from, what happened, what's changed the horror genre,
all the deals,
why we like scary movies, yada yada,
the whole shebang.
Personally, I'm afraid of scary movies.
I love a scary movie.
I love to watch it, but I won't, like, I will be hiding, like, behind a pillow the entire time.
I just, like, want to be freaked out all the time. Yeah. You know, my goal is to always be uncomfortable.
A psychological, like, thriller fucks me up.
Okay, so let's start. Should we do the podcast?
Yeah, I guess so.
So I'm gonna talk you guys through some history. I'm gonna do a little history of like the horror genre in general, and then also history of like horror movies. And then Madison's gonna talk you through like subcategories, top horror.
Yeah, like movies. Some horror movies that really like changed the game or like mm-hmm. brought something new to the table. And then a little bit about like why we like scary movies and some fake psychology behind it.
Love fake psychology.
My fake psychology degree gets me so far.
Psychology.
Don't we don't hit me.
Alrighty. Here I go with the history. So, we are gonna, like, I'm gonna mainly focus on horror movies, throughout this entire episode, and, like, that with the horror genre aspect, but, like, before we get to that, I am going to first give you guys some information on, like, the definition of the horror genre, and just history about the genre in general. So, first, what is or what defines the horror genre, you may ask me, Madison?
I do ask you that.
Well, horror, as one might call it, is a genre of fiction which is intended to or has the capacity to frighten, scare, disgust, or startle. I was like, what word did I write here? Startle its readers or viewers by including feelings of horror and terror. The stories focus on creating a feeling of fear. So that's the definition of horror. A lot of these tales and like horror genre tales that we hear are of ancient origin and form a substantial part of the body of folk literature. And like what I'm going to talk about first, because as most things happen, literature becomes like comes before movies. These bodies of work usually feature supernatural elements such as ghosts, witches, or vampires, or even sometimes address more realistic psychological fears.
I do have a lot of fears. Many of them psychological.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to go all the way back. All the way back.
Take me back.
To 1235.
Oh.
It was lunchtime.
The year 1235. What was I doing then? I was probably like, you know, a little toddler.
Oh, talk to me more about it.
No.
Okay. So, in 1235, the Vatican issued...
Give it up for the Vatican, everybody. In 1235, Vatican, they had it together.
Really, really kicked us off with horror. So, the Vatican issued an order to reestablish the orthodoxy of the faith. This is very important. Mm. So, almost immediately, charges of heresy were coming about. They were tangled up in with allegations of witchcraft. This resulting in the obsession with, this is like what resulted in the obsession with witchcraft, which would spiral for centuries later, as we know. And like, it's important because witchcraft and like what you look through a lot of the research that I found is like witchcraft was like one of the first things that like established the horror genre was everybody was like witches. So now we're scared. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it. So it just spiraled. So then after that, in 1307, Dante published the first volume of his Divine Comedy Inferno. The vision of Satan Dante presented would prove heavily influential, like, throughout history in this. So, like, this was, like, the first, not the first time, but it was, like, the one of the first times that somebody was, like, this is what Satan looks like, and he's scary.
He's a red man with devil horns.
Yeah, basically, literally, like, somebody painted what Satan would look like. So then, for the next century, works of horror would still, like, be largely tied to religion because of, you know, these things. So then, in 1486, inquisitors Henry Kramer and Jacob Spencer published the Malus Maleficarium, which is the Hammer of Witches, the book, which codified a belief in witchcraft, which was reprinted 14 times throughout Europe by 1520, because it was that good. And then it contributed to the witch crave and other, like, spooky rumor shit that, you know, grew and grew over the next centuries. So then by 1580, we discovered horror on the stage, which was very important. The London stage, to be specific. So
thank you, London.
So there was a series of gruesome plays, such as the Spanish tragedy, which was 1585. We had some Shakespeare in there. Titus Andronicus, Hamlet, Macbeth.
My man.
We had the Duchess of Malfi.
Ah,
scary.
Terrifying. Really takes me back.
Really, if you're from UNCSA.
Really takes me back.
Gets you.
That Bible, am I right?
Isaac Powell, we love you.
This one's for you, baby.
So, anyways. So then, you know, whatever. So then we skip forward to 1714 when Thomas Parnell published A Night Piece of Death. This was the first work of the so-called graveyard poets. So they're also sometimes called the churchyard poets, but the group was made up of pre-romantic poets known for their preoccupation with morality and death. Oliver Goodsmith, William Cowper, James McPherson, Robert Blair, Thomas Chatterton. These were some of the many graveyard poets.
Love a good graveyard poet.
Mm-hmm. I'm a graveyard poet.
Yorick, is that you?
Yes. So, like, though, like, most critics, like, dismissed their works and everything, like, their efforts did not go unnoticed and, like, heavily contributed to the evolution of what is super important to us in the horror genre, the gothic novel. The gothic novel.
The gothic novel. You're a gothic novel.
Yeah, kind of. That's kind of true. So we move on. So then we get to the Western. That's us.
So the West.
So in Western literature specifically, the literary like cultivation of fear and curiosity for its own sake began to emerge in the 18th century. So this was, you know, pre-Romantic era, and this was with the Gothic novel. The genre was invented by Horace Walpole. His full name was Horace Walpole, 4th Earl of Orford. His original name was Horito Walpole.
How annoying.
Thanks for having 12 names. So he was an English writer, a connoisseur, and a collector known for his novel, The Castle of Otranto.
When in doubt, and you see a word in Italian and you don't know how to say it, just lay on the thick Italian accent and you say, Otranto, and it'll sound mwah.
Exactly. So the Castle of Otranto was written in 1764.
Sorry to the Italians.
I'm so sorry. It was the first Gothic novel in the English language and was one of the earliest literary complete horror stories.
Okay.
And so, because of this novel, and then like a lot of his other work, it is said that Horace founded the horror story as a legitimate literary form. So thank you, Horace.
Is that why it's called horror? Horace, horror?
Horace, horror.
Or is it not at all related?
Honestly, I don't know. Okay. But I love that conclusion for us.
I hope so.
Horace, the horror monster. So then basically after Horace, we had all types of, you know, people coming out the wazoo, writing their horror stories. And like, it is debated on like who was the next like biggest person and like all of these things. But what like I found often was that Mary Wollstonecraft, Shelley was our...
I was going to say, a different Mary?
No. Shelley was our next biggest literary genius in the horror genre.
Gotcha.
For introducing pseudoscience into the genre and helping expand it with her famous novel, Frankenstein.
Good old Frankie.
Truly, I miss Frankie. And that was in 1818. So this was our beginning. Horace put us on the map. We got some other people putting us on the map, and then we toe-dived. We dipped our toe into the pool of horror. So the horror story was then raised to a level far above mere entertainment, like through skillful intermingling of reason and madness. We had eerie atmospheres, and like everyday reality was all twisting and turning. So this was due to the Romantic era German storyteller, E.T.A. Hoffman, and our good friend, Edgar Allan Poe.
Poe, my dear friend.
Yeah. So they invested in spectacle, basically, in their stories and, like, with their writing and with the things they, like, basically started saying that we needed a psychological symbolism to, like, horror stories. And so that gave, like, their tales a haunting... And, like, a haunted credibility, basically. So, basically, they were building something bigger than, like, just this, like, tiny genre. They were pulling the horror off the page and creating an entire world for it through their writing. Mm-hmm. Like icons.
Good work.
Truly good work. So, then, after that, the influence of Hoffman and Poe, the Gothic influence persisted throughout the 19th century and many a work. Some of these works included The House by the Churchyard and Green Tea, The Moonstone, Dracula. So that all happened. Then the influence was then revived in the 20th century by many a science fiction and fantasy writer. Some of these 20th century masters of horror were Mervyn Peake, Amber Rose Bierce, Arthur McHenn, and many other. Stephen King.
Good old Stephen.
Yeah. And so they, you know, we had tons of writers. And then there were also like a handful of isolated horror masterpieces that had been like produced by writers not associated with the genre, but everyone like basically started getting their phalanges in the horror pool.
Mm-hmm.
The horrible. Some of the best known.
I'm terrible. I do not want to be in the horror pool.
Could you imagine? Mm-hmm. Some of the best known horror stories basically owe their power and like full bodied characters that we have now, that developed in the realistic social environments, and to the like very absence of a mystery, like mysterious atmosphere that like we started talking about with our good friend Poe and Hoffman. And like this is becoming more and more common in the genre today, both in movies, books, all around in the genre. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what happens with the like timeline basically of horror and like the literary timeline of horror, I want to say. Mm-hmm. So then like there's, you know, obviously a lot of other writers and like things that happened, and people that did things and contributed to the genre. We just don't have time to speak about all of them. So then we get to a point where like we kept hitting new accomplishments in horror, like horror for children and all these things. It was like subgenres, but like specifically for like literary situations. And so we basically had to like come up with a new thing. And we like got to a place where it was time to like put it on the screen or put it somewhere else to test the success like of the genre. So that's where we started talking about movies.
The moving pictures.
Truly the moving pictures.
On the big screen.
On the big screen.
Well, I never.
Truly, well, I never. So, of course, like we were talking about, the Gothic novel laid the foundation, like, for future film adaptations featuring, like, classic characters like Frankenstein, like Dracula, like Jacqueline and Hyde, Hunchback of Notre Dame, even the Phantom of the Opera.
Da, 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 da.
My favorite horror story.
You know I was Phantom of the Opera for Halloween one year?
Of course you were.
Because my dad works at a tuck shop, so I got a suit from the tuck shop, had the mask, and just, like, straightened my hair. Middle school was a weird time, man. And my friend went as Christine.
I could cry. Where's the picture?
I'll show you a picture.
I'm gonna cry. Oh my gosh. Oh god.
These little nuggets of joy that I give to you.
Thank you, nuggets. So film, a mess. So film basically became one of the most, and one of the easiest ways to tell the stories, and to continue them in horror and everything. But we're specifically talking about horror, if you didn't know.
Damn right.
I
don't come for anything else.
So a horror filmologist said that horror films were the present-day version of the epic poems and ballads told around the fires of our ancestors. How beautiful.
Talk to me about these fires and these ancestors.
You know, sitting around the fire, flannel on, jeans, probably some Vans.
A s'mores.
Oh, maybe a s'more.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe a hot chocolate.
Like a Jiffy Pop.
Ooh.
I used to love a Jiffy Pop over a fire.
Why?
Because I'm psychotic.
Oh, God.
Continue, please.
So, now we dive into history timeline of horror films. And, like, this timeline is not, like, obviously every single thing that happened, but the big accomplishments are big moments. And, like, throughout the centuries, kind of, what brought us to different points in the horror film. So, here we go. We start with The House of the Devil. In 1896.
Mm.
That's where I feel like I am right now. The House of the
Welcome
Devil.
To the House of the Devil.
It was directed by I can't say his last name. I'm so sorry, Jorge. It was considered the first horror film ever made. And it was actually deemed like lost until a copy turned up at the New Zealand Film Archive in 1988. So it was like, it was there and then
it was like under a cabinet somewhere there, and then it was like, gone. Oh shit.
Yeah. And they were like, what's this? And then somebody popped it in and was like, what? So we found it. The title of the movie has been translated many a times. It's been translated to The Manor of the Devil, The Haunted Castle, The Devil's Manor, and The Devil's Castle. So it's this series of sketches, that begins with a bat transferring into a character who is an agent of the devil. Metastopheles, if you want to know his name.
Oh, mm-hmm. Good old Metastopheles.
So, with the help of his assistant, he conjures demonic entities from a cauldron, which then go on to prank two men who enter the castle. In the end, one of the men uses a crucifix to make him disappear.
I feel like I know this story.
Yeah, it's like... The story.
I feel like this is like, it was a theater history. Like, also, yeah. Like a play was similar to this something.
It's like a thing that like a lot of people started like writing. You know,
they were like, this is a fun one.
Yeah, but it's like the first, it is what we call the first horror story. Mm-hmm. So the film was actually filmed in the director's garden outside his home.
Cool.
Yeah, it was, they were like, they filmed it in like his garden in Seine Saint-Denis. Like,
I'm sure it was like not home. A garden, like it wasn't like a little garden. It was like a sprawling acres garden.
Yes, literally. And like also you can't tell, like I watched it and it's like I watched like 4 minutes of it on YouTube and it's, you know, obviously black and white, it's like very old, you're like, what,
you're like, is talk there to me anything talk to me about what's going on?
Yeah. So the film obviously like now doesn't particularly seem scary because it's not up to the par of what we see in horror, but like back then, in 1896, the film had the most cutting-edge special effects of its day. Some of those effects were the first to ever appear on film in that time during this. Lots of people popping in and out of smoke. Yeah, you know, disappearing, come back like the devil.
Disappear in a cloud of smoke.
Yep. lots of clown tricks.
A magician, you might say.
Yes. Truly. So yeah, that's the like first horror film. So then, in early 1900s, German filmmakers, we hop over to Germany.
Take the bus, you know?
Take the bus to Germany. So German filmmakers advanced the genre considerably. Paul Wegener's The Gomme in 1915, and Robert Wine's The Cabinet of Dr. Caldry, and then there's a couple of other ones that are, like, all outstanding examples of on-screen innovations in horror. This expansion, like, that was happening was basically because they were just, like, making shit up all the time. So they were like, we got all types of time to make all types of shit.
The Germans
were
really on it.
Keep doing it. Yeah. And it was basically inspired because there was a ban on foreign films during World War One, so they had to... They had to make all their own things, literally.
Nosferatu, there you go.
Nosferatu! Iconic. So that's how we got some of our best horrors. So basically, like, German filmmakers had plenty of opportunity to develop a national style of horror film, and it was heavily influenced by the Expressionist movement in the German fine arts. So...
Chef's kiss.
Chef's kiss always. So while this was happening, back at the ranch, aka America, Gothic novels were getting full-on big-screen treatment, Madison. Edison Studios released its first adaptation of Frankenstein. Hammer Film Productions released their first adaptation of the classics, including Dracula and The Mummy. We were doing all types of adapting over here. And so then after this, we get into like an era of gimmicks and realistic supernatural situations and starting to push the envelope some more. So basically, like after Germany, our next thing that happens is that like Europe was recovering from World War II now. We've moved from World War I to World War II.
Knock, knock, who's there? World War II.
Yeah. So, the, like, plot of invasion and atomic war cast a long shadow over, like, the horror genre at this point. So, with this situation, we have theatrical gimmicks, and over-exaggerations, and filmmakers started to move into how to tell, like, the stories that we were living, but in, like, with these theatrical gimmicks, with some over-exaggerations to make us feel a little safer. Examples, Godzilla.
Because if there's nothing that makes me feel safer,
it's Godzilla. You know, talking about radioactivity, but in a fun way.
Yeah.
There was the War of the Worlds in 1953, alien invasion, all those things.
Like, these things are happening with real people, but let's put an alien in there.
Exactly. That's how you tell the story.
Yeah.
Storytelling. So then, generally speaking, like, audiences' reactions to these films were positive, and it inspired a movie, like, the movie business, to experiment with a variety of other theatrical gimmicks, including, intended to, like, attract even more people to watch horror films. And then directors started, like, throwing all types of shit into films that were, like, this is scary, like, started putting barf bags in theaters and, like, making it, like, an entire spectacle. Like, it wasn't just, like, about the film anymore. It was about, like, the entire environment. And then, like, there was one fun fact that I liked, which was the director, William Castle, and in particular was known for his gimmicks in the theater. He once purchased fright insurance for audiences during screenings of his film, guaranteeing that if someone died of fright, their family would receive $1,000.
Huh. I wish I could die of fright. That's the way I want to go.
That's the way you want to go?
Just spook me to death.
Spook to death.
That's it.
Oh, God.
What? Yeah. That's very nice of him.
Fright insurance.
Thank you for the fright insurance.
$1,000.
I'll take, like, just $1,000.
Truly, I'll take $1,000. So then we, like, move on to the 1960s. Which was a decade of revolution in Hollywood. Film technology started to become more accessible, and the studios, like, the big budget movies in the studios were, like, kind of flopping, like, things weren't going well. So this was a great time for independent filmmakers, and they were seizing the opportunity. These independent filmmakers worked to shock audiences with situations and images and expose audiences to scary but seemingly realistic situations that pushed the envelope for what was acceptable to be shown on the screen. Example is the landmark zombie film Night of the Living Dead in 1968, which was, like, at that time a big thing, but today, like, in the film industry, is also considered a commentary on race and also, like, the Vietnam War and everything. So we started pushing the envelope even more. So then pushing the envelope in 1960s took a dark turn in 1970s. As I wrote, my film and movieologist in this article said, after the optimism of the 1960s, with its sexual and cultural revolutions and the moon landings, the 70s were somewhat of a disappointment. The Beatles broke up, so the party was over.
Truly, the Beatles broke up, so the party was over.
You know, we had Nixon issues, all types of shit was going on. 70s. It was not a good time. But two things happened for horror movies, Madison.
What were they?
Well, the 70s made for respectable horror content because it could showcase contemporary issues, addressing genuine psychological fears that we were having.
Like, rats, the Beatles will never get back together.
Yeah.
my big 1970s fears.
My 1970s horror nightmares. And then the second thing was that the 70s had a very big thematic through line in the era, which was children and childbirth. So
I am afraid of children.
Yes, exactly. So horror movies began to suggest that children could be scary and capable of terrible things.
Yeah,
they can.
Damn straight.
And so there was many, like, a suggestion that, like, the family unit was not only vulnerable, but also, like, compromised by supernatural forces, like, in cases of films. So then, you know, we had Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, Poltergeist, all types of shit.
Yeah.
Thank you, children, for being the scariest motherfuckers I know. Mm-hmm. And so then, in 1974, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre kicks off our 1980s, like, big film accomplishments. It was just a little bit early. The 80s were early. So we start with slasher films. I'm not gonna talk much about the, like, slasher genre because that's gonna be a Madison situation. But we exploded, we started, like, exploding this subgenre of slasher films. And so the late 70s and into the 80s birthed classics such as Halloween, Friday the 13th, A Nightmare on Elm Street, all these things. These films that were super popular horror films, and have sequels, some of them that are continuing to this day, and fan followings.
Mm-hmm. Didn't we just do a new Halloween, like, recently?
Yeah, like, literally, yeah. So recently, I think.
Yeah.
So, people love them.
Yeah.
So then we reach the 1990s. So the...
The
90s. The 90s, baby. So this article names the section about the 90s and films in the 90s. The 90s, doldrums, the torture porn, and today's horrible film renaissance.
Ah, yeah, that feels right.
Yeah, that was us.
It feels true.
That was us. So, but many an expert basically said that, like, and horror, like, fan, so that they felt that horror slumped in the 1990s as audiences burned out on some of the adrenaline of, like, the slasher era mm-hmm. and everything that came before it because we were, like, so high and, like, going at such a rapid pace. So then some filmmakers were actually able to capitalize on this and, like, on the horror fatigue, as you could call it, I guess, producing parodies that, like, still managed to scare, such as Scream or I Know What You Did Last Summer, mm-hmm. which made it big. Other filmmakers decided to, like, start telling more of a, like, grounded, plausible story, like serial killers prominently being seen as antagonists and, like, driving classics like Silence of the Lambs and things like that. And so this was, you know, all the 90s, people were trying to figure out what was going to be the most popular, what was going to be the next big thing, what they could do to make the 90s better.
Really, what could you do to make the 90s better?
Because, yikes. And then, like, the turn of the millennium brought about a branching of sorts in horror films. The rapid birth of subgenres, as Madison's going to talk about, started. We had...
I keep looking panicked at Nina. I did do research for subgenres, I promise.
I hope she doesn't talk about them. We basically had, like, all types of things going on. We had the Blair Witch Project. Yeah. We had The Ring, The Grudge. We had some, like, extreme violence. Saw. We had all these things that was, like, that were going on because no one could figure out, like, one thing that could be popular.
We said, welcome to the 2000s, yeah, baby.
We said, why don't we just... live in chaos. So lots of experts, like, theorize that the direction of horror films and horror genre reflects, like, a shift of the society that was happening at that point. This was spurred around and, like, by 9/11. So, like, this event basically changed, like, what was frightening to us as humans. It was no longer, you know, all the things that we were seeing in, like, slasher films and things like that. And it was, like, now, like, a real world situation. Mm-hmm. So it, like, set a cultural agenda for the following years. And we got into, like, a situation where we had to, like, drastically change and adjust what, like, a monster looked like on the screen in horror movies. And so we stopped having, you know, psychopaths of the 90s and everything before that, and we started seeing monsters that were, like, reminiscent of, like, Bin Laden and, like, that type of situation, which, you know, creates a lot of other things.
There's some issues
that are big issues, but that's, you know, what the early 2000s brought to us.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so then we brought, you know, Saw, and we had, like, other atrocities that were happening, like we talked about. And so the thing that was, like, kind of happening with the horror genre at this point was, you know, making things so horrible as to feel, like, removed from the viewer. And it becomes, like, an interesting take on how a time of true global terror, like, may have influenced the cinema and making something, like, so scary that, like, it is, like, in practice is not worth fearing at all in mm-hmm. that situation. So... what about today, you ask me?
I do.
Where are we today with this situation?
Where are we today?
Well, Hollywood likes to throw a lot of money around in, like, superhero movies and such like that. So, yeah. Like, it's not that we don't have a lot of money in horror is what I was reading. But, like, film creators are filling the hole in the market with aid of, like, smaller distributions. So throwing it back to, like, what they were doing in the 60s and 70s. And, like, the horror genre is now seen as most successful by those who tend to, like, thrive and become creative and, like, show creative expression through, like, experimentation and, like, lower budgets. Example, Get Out. Which went from, you know, Sundance to the Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
And the, like, reflective of the type of horror work that we see a lot, like, now, which is a reflection of our society. And, like, I read a whole Jordan, like, Peele quote about how he talked about, like, you know, just basically what we talk about with horror and what we talk about with everything is, like, it, this movie and like Get Out is now a reflection of what, not only like what horror has to be now, but like what life is now. Like we are very much in a place where we need to see things that are real in order to like, not to just like connect with them, but like to fear them and all of those things. Mm-hmm. So that was a thing. Obviously we still do have like big budget horror movies, aka the Purge franchise.
Yeah.
Purge. My favorite Purge. But by like large, we are currently in the midst of independently minded horror films. Get Out, like I said, A Quiet Place, Mandy. Yeah. So these are like all films produced by visionary directors with something unique to show and say. So in conclusion, like it's going to be interesting in what filmologist and movieologist are looking at is to see like what kind of horror films society fears like will be next in the next decade as we march on.
Just someone coming out of the screaming stabbing you.
As life gets scarier and scarier. So that's kind of our like horror timeline and how we get to where we are today, why we see what we do on the screen.
Mm. We see many things.
We see many a thing. Mm. And I'm often spooked.
Truly terrifying.
But yeah, that's the timeline situation.
Well, you mentioned some subgenres.
No, I didn't. I did not say the word subgenre once.
And I may have some information for you.
Talk to me.
All right. I'll kick it off with talking about some subcategories of the horror genre. And like a lot of movies fit into multiple categories. Or usually like take one or two or like some elements of some and some of others. But like, and then there's like very clear examples of like, oh, this is definitely a slasher film, mm-hmm. or like this. So it's interesting to see like where movies fall or like how people pick up on the trends of subgenres and are like, okay, cool. Like, you know, psychological horrors are really big. So like, mm-hmm. let's do a lot of those. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So starting it off, psychological horror. Psychological horror films rely on mental and emotional fear rather than violence or monsters, focusing on character state of mind throughout the story. Examples of psychological horrors include The Shining, Silence of the Lambs, and Psycho. So it's way more. I always think of Split.
Mm.
That one.
That's what I'm talking about. Fuck me up.
Yeah, like I
want my mind. Take my mind and squish it.
Be like gone. And those I feel like are really big right now. Of like, it's a lot of like messing with your like messing even your like mind. You think of Midsommar.
Oh yeah.
Which like of like how like the little details of like, you know, I think of like the blades of grass going through her hand, mm-hmm. and like, or like the small details on the side like that. People talked about that for so long.
Yeah, they're like the ones that like I feel like you watch the first time to just like be scared, you know, and then like you like have to watch it like two or three more times to be like,
you're like what.
You'd be like, did you what? See that?
Did that's you see that? That? Yeah, that connects like, to later.
Yeah, it's that thing.
And then we also have slasher films, which we've talked a lot about before. Usually focus on a serial killer, think Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger, as they go after a group of people. Classic slasher films include Halloween, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, and The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We also have gore films. They are also called splatter films. Gross.
Splatter films!
They zero in on the vulnerability of the human body, often with frequent close-ups. Examples of gore films include Evil Dead and Saw. If you've ever seen Saw, it's only gore.
If you haven't seen Saw, turn this podcast off right now and go watch Saw.
You could. There's like, what, 8 of them to choose from?
Yeah.
And like one called Jigsaw.
Yeah.
There's so many
options. There's so many.
It's like the Final Destination movies. There's like how
there's
many?
There's like 200 of them. Yeah.
We then have body horror, which is closely related to gore. Films in body horrors, the subgenre, may feature scenes of the human body that have been severely altered. Filmmaker David Cronenberg is considered a pioneer in the body horror subgenre. Horror films that feature body horror include The Fly, The Thing, and The Exorcist. Yeah, grody.
The Fly.
Not The Fly.
Not The Fly.
We have found footage. Found footage is a horror genre in which the film is portrayed as if it were discovered by the filmmakers rather than created by them. For instance, main characters finding footage of an unknown evil on an old video recorder. Examples of found footage films include The Blair Witch Project and Cloverfield.
My Roanoke Nightmare.
Found footage ones get me because I'm like, I want to believe it's real. So
I want to believe this is real.
There was it was a podcast that I listened to a while back called, you probably listened to it, Limetown.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, I remember our friend Kyle recommended it to me, and I started listening to it on, like, my drive, like, along, I think it was going from, like, Michigan to North Carolina, and I was listening to it, and I had to stop it and call Kyle, and I was like, tell me if this is real or fake right now, because, like, I wasn't, like, I was, like, a couple episodes in, so it gets, like, super serious, and I was like, I need to know if this is real or fiction right now.
Because I will cry, it's one of those that you're just like...
I love, like, being like, is this a real thing?
Literally, is this a real thing? How come no one told me about this?
Why do I not know?
Yeah.
And then we have monster horror. Many horror films capitalize on the fear of the unknown by featuring frightening monsters from science fiction and dark fantasy. Werewolves, vampires, you know, the Twilight faves. Aliens are often main antagonists of the horror subgenre, because what is Twilight but a horror film? I feel terrified.
I will argue with you. Twilight is a horror film.
And most recently, undead and zombie films have been an especially popular form of the classic monster movie. Some even now consider zombie movies to be its own subgenre because there's just so many out there, and it became very popular.
There's many a zombie movie.
We love a good zombie movie. Nothing fucks me up more than a fast moving zombie. Like, what was that? It was like World War Z, I think.
Yeah.
They went fast.
Yeah.
They move speed.
They like, yes. Oh my God. I remember when we watched that.
Yeah.
It's all coming back to me, all the flashbacks.
Well, it's just one of those, because like, you think of zombies as like, they're slow and moving slowly.
And it's like,
and then
like,
we said fast.
Yeah. They like really move fast. They like, they know how to do everything. You're scared. It's terrifying.
Yeah. No.
It really gets me.
Examples of the monster horror films include Night of the Living Dead, Resident Evil, Dawn of the Dead, Jaws, Godzilla, Frankenstein, Dracula, The Mummy, and Alien.
Jaws, a chef's kiss masterpiece.
So good.
If one might say. If I do say so myself.
You know, all they wanted to do was close down the beach to prevent people from getting killed. It's an interesting theory if you think about it right now.
Huh. Weird.
Ties into something going on these days, don't you think?
The jaws of COVID. My horror film.
Welcome
to my Roanoke nightmare.
And then we have paranormal horror. The paranormal horror subgenre is similar to monster horror, but rather than featuring corporeal beings, real things, as the normal folks say, paranormal horror focuses on the monsters we can't touch, like supernatural entities like ghosts, spirits, and demons. Paranormal films often feature haunted houses, possession, exorcism, or occult worship. Examples of paranormal horror include The Exorcist, Paranormal Activity, The Conjuring. I couldn't finish The Paranormal Activity.
I thought
it was so dumb.
I love a paranormal film. I like, the paranormal ones are the ones that, like, I have a lot of friends that are like, it's scary. And I'm like, it's not scary, but like, it's so interesting to be like, talk to me. Talk to me more.
I want
to
hear more
about this.
We also have Amityville Horror, The Omen, Carrie, and Poltergeist. We then have comedy horror, which ties, I'll talk a little bit more about it later when I talk about mainly Scream. But there's also meta horror, which these two kind of like, play into each other, because a lot of times comedy horrors are ones that are very self-aware, which are the meta-horror.
Mm-hmm.
Horror doesn't always have to leave your skin crawling. Mm. There is an entire subset of horror movies that aims to make you laugh at the same time. Examples of comedy horror include Scream, The Cabin in the Woods, which is one of my faves.
The Cabin in the Woods is an iconic
one.
Good. It's an iconic
one. Can we watch it?
Yeah.
Okay. Shaun of the Dead and Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
I haven't seen that one in a while.
Yeah. And then we also have folk horror. Folk horror is a subgenre that explores the terror of the unknown in nature and rural regions beyond the safe confines of the urban life. You know, the good old urban life, city life.
It's given me my Roanoke nightmare vibes. Yes.
We see folk horror cross into other genres, but it remains strong with its core themes and classics like Children of the Corn and modern films like Midsommar.
Scary. It's really Children
Never
of
trust
the
a
corn.
Child.
Never trust a child is my constant theme in life. So
that's like the main like subgenres and like how we choose to break down horror films. So yeah, I'll talk about some top horror films is like a hard thing, so I went away from that and I was like, let's just talk about some films that made a difference.
Yeah.
Like that like changed the genre or yeah. like sparked a wave of films yeah. that we decided to create.
All these, you know, horror assholes are like, no, that's not the top one. It's like, this one.
You didn't mention The Shining. I'm like, I'm sorry.
You didn't mention The Shining. Yeah, that's really how I feel about horror people.
Yeah. Okay, so horror movies captivate audiences looking for a good fright, but they also play a bigger role with influencing pop culture and the film industry. Mm. Film critics cite Jaws as ending the Hollywood era of launching, ending a Hollywood era and launching the craze for summer blockbusters, because they were like, they launched at the beginning of the summer and everyone was like, we're gonna go see Jaws, and that's yeah. all we care about! You know, as you do.
A summer where all I care about is Jaws. that's my dream.
That's it. And then you think of the Blair Witch Project, which launched the found footage subgenre and went on to enormous success thanks in part to one of the first viral marketing campaigns. And I'll talk about that a little more later. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some viral horror movies. Mm-hmm. You mentioned this one earlier, starting way back, and this isn't chronological, so I'll just kind of make our way forward. So The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Mm-hmm.
Calligraphy. Dr. Caligari, sure. This 1920 German silent film is widely considered the first true horror movie. While a few earlier films dealt with supernatural, ominous themes, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari established the foundations of the genre. Another German horror film, Nosferatu, followed 2 years later and also deeply influenced the popularity of the horror genre. Mm-hmm. You love Nosferatu?
I do. I'm very passionate
about it. I just
think
of the SpongeBob episode of the hash-slinging slasher, and they're like, who's been turning the lights on and off? And they turn and look at this Nosferatu flicking the lights on, and they all go, Nosferatu! And I'm like, what?
I'm very passionate about Nosferatu.
I love that for you. this film also played a major role in the German Expressionist movement, which sought to depict dark emotions like madness and confusion by using exaggerated plots and unrealistic settings.
Mm.
The Germans were just like, hello, we are going to control film right now. Yeah, thank you, good night.
They really did.
And then we go to Frankenstein, which was encouraged by the success of its Dracula adaptation. Universal Studios adapted Mary Shelley's classic gothic novel, Frankenstein, in 1931. Frankenstein became a major hit for the studio, and Boris Karloff, with his square-headed monster makeup, became a horror icon. Universal Studios kept cranking out monster movies, including Mummy, Wolfman, and Creature from the Black Lagoon, and Universal Monsters became pop culture icons in a way that no other horror characters had before. Mm. And I, like, talked a lot about how, like, it influenced, like, you know, like, kids would have, like, Frankenstein on their lunchbox, or they'd dress up like it for Halloween. For like, sure. You know, it was, like, the first time that they had seen, like, you know, like, kids were dressing up like Nosferatu. As sad as that, like, as much as I wish. They were like, Frankenstein, that's it.
That's
Mom,
my man.
Put some bolts in my head and call it a day.
It's really, like,
take some green jello and, like, rub it on my face and call it a day.
Call it a day.
And then, let's talk about, Bloodfest. I liked the starting line, that the article had, and it said, movies don't have to be good to be influential. And I said, that is true.
That is true.
Before Bloodfest's 1963 release, horror films would artistically show brutal and violent murder through shots of, like, blood drops or, like, a camera panning away from the action, like, mm-hmm. very dramatic, like, mm-hmm. a scream and, like, a bolt of lightning.
Boom, boom, boom.
And it'd be like, oh, she's dead.
Clue style.
Clue. Bring back Clue. My biggest passion is Clue.
I know.
But Bloodfest was the first, was really the first splatter movie, mm-hmm. made specifically to show disgusting bloody things on screen. Mm. Legs are chopped off, brains splashed on the floor, a woman's tongue is pulled from her mouth.
You know, Titus Andronicus style.
And it forced film censorship boards to redefine how they treated film violence while paving the way for graphic violence to leak into the mainstream. Can you imagine, like, the censor board was just like, oh, God, oh, jeez.
Oh, jeez.
We need to create 17 new ratings.
Like, oh, my gosh.
Like, what do we, like, watch is, like, you know, just, like, see something and it's just like, oh, God, no, we have
truly?
To.
Truly? Oh, my gosh,
to,
no.
We have to fix this. And then we'll go on to The Exorcist.
Thank you.
good. When a young girl is possessed by a demon, a pair of Catholic priests struggle to exorcise the evil... Exorcise the evil spirit while suffering doubt in their own faith. Based on the 1971 novel by William Peter Blatty, this 1973 horror movie stunned audiences not with the over-the-top gore or shocking violence, but with a pervasive sense of dread. And, like, the article was like, don't get me wrong, there's violence, you know, a girl's head spins around and she projectile vomits. And I was like, that is true.
That does happen.
But the corruption of innocence and a realistic style that hinted at true horrors lurking in our everyday lives was, like, really what it was about. And it was the way The Exorcist incorporated Judeo-Christian mythology of demonic spirits and a very literal battle between good and evil that made waves. Mm-hmm. Billy Graham, who was like a popular evangelist at the time, proclaimed that the movie itself was possessed by demons. And some towns in Britain banned the movie.
It was,
because The Exorcist was so dark that there's a persistent legend that the production of the movie was cursed. It was.
I don't know if you guys know this, but it was.
Look into it, because it's some really, like, spooky shit that happened.
The Exorcist is, like, one of the ones that, like, I love, but because of that is, like, you're like, well, I don't know what to tell you, but after The Exorcist was filmed, everybody was haunted.
Yeah. So. Truly everybody was haunted. The devil said, good morning. and then we go on to Halloween. One slasher movie stands above the rest as the original. The movie that both created and perfected the form, John Carpenter's Halloween, was released in 1978. With Halloween, Carpenter established the tropes that are reused, recycled, and paid tribute to by hundreds of subsequent movies about relentless stalkers and killers. The movie's success immediately spawned a slasher craze of the 1980s. Friday the 13th, My Bloody Valentine, Sleepaway Camp, Sorority House Massacre, which I've never heard of, but that sounds wild.
Sorority House Massacre?
And dozens of others, not to mention the remakes and the sequels of the original Halloween, because there's so many.
Yeah.
So many. It's been like 40 years.
Sorority House Massacre, Madison, reminds you of, okay, remember that one episode of Wizards of Waverly Place?
Yeah.
Where Alex gets stuck in that sorority house movie?
Yeah.
That's what it is. Mm. It's basically that, but in real life.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. What an obscure reference. And then we have the Blair Witch Project. Made in 1998 for about $60,000, Blair Witch generated $140 million.
I was Blair Witch.
Literally iconic. Found footage movies are remarkably cheap to make since they use a small crew and often rely on natural lighting and actual locations instead of manufactured sets. Mm-hmm. It's usually, like, spent on, like, the little, like, you know, shit that they have to have happen or, like, the situations that they encounter. The Blair Witch Project wasn't the first found footage movie. Mondo Cain was a 1962 movie that basically, like, wanted to show actual footage of bizarre events. Like, that's what they made people believe. I can't pronounce the word I wrote.
I love a good, like, look at my notes, like, who wrote this?
I don't know who
it wasn't
was
me.
And who thought I could pronounce this word, but it wasn't me. And then in the 1980s, Cannibal Holocaust faked realism so well that the producers were investigated for committing actual murders on the film. They didn't. Don't you worry. That's what they say.
So that's what they tell me. I guess I gotta believe them.
How did the Blair Witch Project get so popular? Great question, Nina.
I was wondering.
Marketing. It was the first movie to use viral marketing, creating buzz with a website, and it was one of the first films to market via a website, because it was still, like, the dawn of the internet.
Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, back in my time.
Mm-hmm. Do you?
Yeah.
In 1998?
Yeah, that was my best time.
Mm-hmm. Anywho.
1 year old.
0 years old. Fake documentaries and other clues about the Blair Witch mystery were, like, dropped to, like, lure people in, and, like, they had a mailing list, and it was, like, a whole thing that, like, everyone was, like, trying to figure out the mystery.
Yeah.
And they realized, like, very, like, I was watching a thing about it, and the actors were talking about, like, how when they first went to Sundance and then, like, were picked up by, they were, like, bought right away by a major film industry. And, like, then they very quickly realized that, like, the actor shouldn't be, like, doing interviews or anything because, like, it makes the mystery so much better if they're, like, quote-unquote dead.
Yeah.
And then, so the Blair Witch It became a model that has been followed by dozens of horror films since, such as, like, Cloverfield. Mm-hmm.
I remember talking about the Blair Witch Project, like, so much, and, like, drama class, and, like, all the things, and, like, you know, that thing about, like, actors, and, like, it was, like, a big, I don't know why, like, I know why, but, like, it was, like, such a thing to talk about, like, when talking about, like, method acting, and, like, all of the acting styles, you know?
Because well, they like, were just, like, we're just gonna, like, put you through this, and, like, you're gonna come up on situations, and, like, just do it.
Just do it. It was the thing. And so I remember talking and like having so many conversations and like reading and looking at the Blair Witch Project and just being like, what the fuck?
I just want to watch a bunch of scary movies now. Your favorite? Scream.
Scream. Not my favorite.
No?
Quite literally.
One of your least?
A 0-star rating.
I love Scream. It's
fight me.
It's so ridiculous. Shaggy from the Scooby-Doo movies, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's all I care about with any movie, really. The Scream franchise is one of the most popular examples of a meta horror film, which is what I was talking about earlier, where the movie knows and understands the tropes and cliches of horror movies. It even allows the characters to understand that they're in a horror movie. So with Scream, a typical mass killer stalks the usual teen victims. However, the killer and some of the victims realize the murders are following standard slasher movie protocol. And, like, you know, you think of the, like, scene where he's like, don't say it, don't say it. And he's like, I'll be right back. You know, classic.
Classic.
It was a runaway success of Wes Craven's Scream that introduced audiences to meta horror, opening the door for self-aware horror movies like Zombieland, another favorite of mine. It's so ridiculous and so good. Seed of Chucky, Jason X, and Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. Mm-hmm. 2012's Cabin in the Woods might be the apex of the meta horror subgenre.
Yes. Correct.
With the characters trapped in a horror movie simulation. Spoilers, sorry. And you learned that so quickly. If you haven't seen Cabin in the Woods,
don't talk to me. Wrong with you.
And a plot that ties all horror movie tropes together into a single theory about of ritual sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, I love it so much. And that's really like some of the like. There's many other like movies that like horror movies that have changed,
right,
you know, the game and done different things. But those are the ones I'm choosing to talk about.
So
there.
Suck it.
Truly suck it. Continuing to talk.
We really like this. Usually it's like a back and forth, like one of us does a topic then the other one does a topic, but we really picked a like you do this entire section and you do this entire section today, and it's really taking a toll.
I'm so tired. But here we go.
My stamina.
So we're gonna talk about psychology. Why do we like scary movies? It's such a good question.
Because I'm a psychopath.
Yeah. Well, here we go.
Talk to me.
So there are a lot of theories on why people love horror films. Mm-hmm. There are some who think that it was the beast within, you know, that it is the beast within kind of situation where an unconscious, repressed part of every human is actually savage. So like, while we disapprove of what the monster is doing deep down, a part of us enjoy seeing the murder and mayhem the monster unleashes, because if we could, we would do that.
I see. So the reason that I like The Exorcist is nice is because I identify
with the devil.
With the devil is what you're telling me.
That one's a little bit of an intense theory. And I was like, yeah, okay. It might be because of our want to root for the protagonist to battle the monster, or we might not endorse the monster's actions, but we find it captivating. We are endlessly fascinated by monstrous entities, psychotic serial killers. So like Ted Bundy, what he did was horrific, but his psychology is so aberrant that we want to understand what he's doing, like what's going on in his head. And so this creates the mystery that draws us in. Mm-hmm. And like, that's kind of like horror movies, because we're like, what the fuck is this guy doing?
Truly, what the fuck? Michael Myers, what is your problem?
Truly, what? Please, take a moment. Take off the mask.
Truly, take off your mask.
Let's have a chat. We talked about psychology of roller coasters a couple episodes ago when we did roller coasters. And there's a theory that's very similar with, like, what I was talking about back then, way back then, 2 weeks ago.
Truly, that was years ago for me.
Some theories focus on the thrill that fear offers, particularly for sensation seekers who may also enjoy other adrenaline-spiking activities such as bungee jumping. The idea is that horror fans are wired or socially formed in such a way that they get a kick out of the fear and other strong visceral sensations from watching horror films. Mm-hmm. Which seems like a very, like, you know, like people who like adrenaline like to sit and like watch a horror movie.
Just scare the shit out of me. I love it.
Yeah. It also is so exciting because there is no real threat, you know, mm-hmm. like... What's great about watching horror movies is you can feel certain, like, strong feelings without suffering the consequences, which allows you to enjoy the sensation, you know?
I don't know, the dreams that I have after watching a horror movie sometimes.
Just might be enough to get
just
you.
Just might be enough.
The fear can also bring people together, you know? It's like surviving a trauma together, but again, without the consequences. Because you're all like, wow, we made it.
Wow, we were scared.
We were scared together. So we thrive together.
It's like when you go through a haunted house with like a group of people, that haunted house experience really brings you together.
And the last theory is that horror movies contain symbolic representations of real fears. So Frankenstein gets at the power of science to alter nature in a fundamental way, while the newer movie Get Out tackles real social and racial fears. And horror films can put us in touch with what we're really afraid of, which are often socially constructed fears. Part of what one marvels at is how cleverly the filmmakers are using the vehicle of horror genre to articulate those real world issues, which is like what you were talking about. A lot of like the newer films that are coming out are really like targeting our fears and like like
they're like ha ha ha.
Like, you know what'd be funny?
When The Purge came out. When The Purge first came out, we were all like, huh, interesting.
You could really do this, couldn't you?
Yep.
Very interesting.
This is really what's happening to me right now.
Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah,
no, there were a couple of, like, articles that I was reading that, like, talked a lot about, like, that and just, like, the idea that, like, horror movies have always been, like, kind of focused or, like, gone after, like, what our fear is at the time. It's just that sometimes, like, our fear is Frankenstein and, like, sometimes our fear is the government.
Yeah.
And, like, that's just what it is.
Well, because, yeah, like, you think back to Frankenstein, they probably were afraid that, like, science was going to alter all of nature and, like, fuck shit up. Yeah. But, like, now I'm like, yeah, science does whatever it wants, but let's talk about some crazy people out there.
The government.
Yeah.
The scariest people of them all.
That's what I got.
Cool. Fun.
Such a good time.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a genre that, like, I don't watch that often, you know?
Yeah.
But, like I don't sit on the couch and, like, watch.
I'm like, ooh, let's sit. We're watching American Horror Story right now.
Yeah,
so
we
are.
Other than, like, American Horror Story. It's, like, much more with, a TV show than a movie, I feel like. Because, like, American Horror Story, I'll sit down all the time and be like, oh, talk to me, Evan Peters.
What are you
talk
doing?
To me, Ryan Murphy.
Why are you being crazy?
Talk to me about your mind.
But, like, sitting down and watching a scary movie is such, like, a, like, you're not, like, hanging out doing that, like, no. You know, it's like a it's an event,
it's a whole commitment I have to make.
Like, you're like, I must sit here and do this.
Cool.
All right,
love it.
Well,
guys,
I guess it's time.
Oh, my favorite time.
You
the
know
only time that matters on this podcast.
Artist of the week. Artist of the week.
That was pretty good.
That was a good one.
That was nice. So
talk to me.
I'm very excited about this week's Artist of the Week. I'm always excited about Artist of the Week, but specifically excited this week.
We've wanted to do this one for a while.
Yeah, we have. So this week's Artist of the Week is Mutiny Club. So it's at MUUTINYCLUB. Mutiny to use. So this shop is a clay earring shop. The creator's name is Maya from Cincinnati, Ohio.
O-H-I-O.
And they make some like beautiful, beautiful earrings. They just rebranded the shop from Maya Collins Goods to Mutiny Club in early September. So there's like that whole rebranding going on. But you can check out their Instagram page to see some of their previous shapes and like patterns and colors, and they're all amazing. There is a link tree in the bio of the Instagram where you can see what earrings they have available in their shop. The link tree also tells you like about the creator slash about the shop, care tips for your earrings, policies, like how to contact them. Like, it's like brilliantly set up. Yeah. It's amazing. So again, go follow at MUUTINY Club and shop and buy some amazing earrings. I have a pair of the like square black and white cow print ones. Mm-hmm. And I'm obsessed with them. I love them. Every time I wear them, people compliment me and always ask me where I get them. I'm like, go buy them. So
here you go. There,
yeah.
Free.
So go buy some earrings.
Yeah. All right.
That's it. It's, you know, it's the end of the podcast where we have to tell you to wear a mask.
Black Lives Matter.
Vote. We're so close.
Oh, it's time.
It is your time to shine.
You better be registered to vote or I will find you.
I'll have to come for you. And like the Purge.
And I'll be so mad to have to leave my couch to come beat your ass.
Yeah. Save the USPS, please.
Please, we need them.
They deserve so much love.
Yeah.
And like I saw on Twitter, sexy cop costumes are out.
Sexy postal workers are in.
So buy your sexy postal worker costume. That's about it, right?
That's it. Happy first episode of Spooktober.
Happy Spooktober, y'all. Love you.
Mwah.
Bye.
Bye.